At this time, I'd like to turn today's program over to Jim McNary. Jim, you may begin.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning or afternoon, depending on which time zone you're in. My name is Jim McNary. I am a partner in the Seyfarth Shaw Litigation Group. I work out of our Sacramento and San Francisco offices. My focus is trade secrets, computer fraud, and non-competes. I'd like to also introduce you to my colleagues who are co-presenting with me today. Justin Beyer of the Chicago office. He, too, is in the litigation group, and he focuses on trade secret, computer fraud, and non-compete work. Mark Hansen is in our Los Angeles office, the downtown location specifically. We work with Mark often on trade secret matters, and Mark is also in our litigation group. With that, I'd like to move to what we will cover today. The big picture here is that we're going to lay some foundation for what we're dealing with. That is, what is a trade secret and what type of information generally qualifies as trade secret within the telecom space. And a quick note on what we're talking about as telecom. Telecom is a very broad description, obviously, but we're referring to wireless telecom, landline-based telecom, internet media, cloud computing, and cable and satellite television. So we're trying to be broad enough to cover multiple interests, but not so focused and detailed in any one sector so as to exclude other interests. We'll be specifically addressing trade secret misappropriation, that is data theft, the cyber and social media threats to telecom trade secrets. It's a very hot area right now generally. Just in today's news, there's Wall Street Journal articles on cyber threats. Best practices for protecting trade secret information, maintaining confidentiality in court filings, third-party relationships, and interactions with the government as regulated entities that are subject to certain filing requirements. Telecom entities from time to time are required to submit documents to the FCC and otherwise. So we'll quickly touch on that. Then finally, recent amendments to the Economic Espionage Act and really the increased heightened scrutiny and focus by the federal government on the problem of misappropriation of trade secrets, what has been done to identify the problem and steps that are being laid and taken to address the problem. And with that, I would like to turn this over to my colleague, Mark Hansen, who is going to address our first topic.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us. We're going to start with the basics, namely, what is a trade secret? The baseline definition in this country as to what a trade secret is set forth in the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which says that a trade secret is information, including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process that derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable by proper means or by persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure or use, and is the subject of efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. Almost all states have adopted this definition in some form. On the screen, you can see an example from California. This definition is virtually identical to that found in the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, with one important exception. The California definition does not include the restriction that the trade secret information not be readily ascertainable. And so California provides greater protection than would be available under the Uniform Trade Secrets definition for trade secret information. As I said, the UTSA, or Uniform Trade Secrets Act, is the national baseline. There are 47 out of 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, that have adopted it. The three holdouts are Massachusetts, New York, and Texas. One thing to remember is that in many jurisdictions, the statutory definition of trade secret may trump some of the common law claims that might otherwise be available to a plaintiff. What is a trade secret? Couple some general things to remember. The information need not be novel or unique. There's no registration that needs to be filed. It's not published. Two or more persons can or entities can possess the trade secret. And it may be made up of things that are not themselves trade secrets, but because of the novel way that they're put together, qualify as trade secret information. Some examples of information that can be and are typically are trade secrets include formulas, manufacturing processes such as know-how, blueprints and engineering drawings, software and databases, business and marketing plans, and detailed customer lists and customer information. In order to qualify as a trade secret, the information must, one, derive independent economic value, which is either actual or potential. As far as independent value, typically that is found in a competitive advantage that the owner of the trade secret realizes by having the information, which is not known in the industry. In terms of economic value, it needs to be something which is financial. The value cannot be historic or sentimental, for example. And actual or potential is pretty obvious. The example of what can't be trade secret in that area would be something that would be past information that is now known generally in the public. The next requirement, is that the information not be generally known or readily ascertainable to the public or people who have knowledge of the subject matter in a particular industry, for example, and who can obtain economic value from the disclosure or use. For example, say Nokia develops an algorithm for a new mobile phone technology that enables wireless telephone calls to be scrambled to enhance privacy. Nokia's competitors would obviously benefit economically from the disclosure and their ability to use that algorithm. Another significant element of information qualifying as a trade secret is that there need to be reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret. This can be done in a number of different ways. Probably one of the best are confidentiality or non-disclosure agreements, which the owner of the trade secret provides to those who he or she are going to provide access. Another area that is important is information security, password protection, email and electronic data policies, confidentiality reminders on the screens. Tying in with that is limiting the access that persons have to the trade secret information. This can be done by segregating files on the information security system and password protecting those with a separate password from the password necessary to access the system itself. It's important that where a breach has occurred, that the owner take action promptly to remedy that, lest the information be deemed to have found its way into the public domain. Particularly for employers, regular training on the confidentiality policies is important, thereby reminding those who have been exposed to them or been aware of them for some time, and also for instructing new employees who have recently joined the organization. Also important are exit interviews to find out, to remind employees of their continuing obligations to preserve the confidentiality of the employer's trade secret information, and to make sure that all documentation, computers, telephones, and things that might otherwise contain the employer's trade secret information are returned by the employee before leaving. It's also important to limit the information made available to vendors and subcontractors. Generally, a good rule of thumb is giving them only what is absolutely necessary for whatever task they are performing for you. Now, it's important to remember that absolute secrecy is not required. It's not necessary to do everything possible to safeguard information, only what's reasonable under the circumstances. On the slide before you, I have cited a case from the Fifth Circuit. It's an older case from 1970, but it's instructive. In that case, DuPont was building a new factory in Texas, and the factory was intended to manufacture methanol. The construction had proceeded, but the roof had not yet been placed on the factory. A third party hired some photographers to fly over the factory and take pictures of the layout in the factory, which was secret to, or was a trade secret of DuPont. DuPont found out about this and sued the photographers. Photographers argued that DuPont had no claim for trade secret theft. The Fifth Circuit found that, basically rejected the argument out of hand, finding that DuPont really wasn't obligated to put a roof over its factory or to cover the factory until the roof was built. So this is an example of applying common sense and what is reasonable under the circumstances. This situation, as you can see, there may be some problems with the efforts to maintain the secrecy. I think this gentleman probably needs to revisit what he's doing to protect his trade secrets. And obviously with this individual, the courts are not going to require him to charter a separate aircraft or even buy the seat next to him. But obviously there are other reasonable steps he can take to protect his trade secrets. With respect to trade secrets in the telecom industry, there are obviously a legion of types of information which are trade secret. Now, the same definition with respect to trade secrets and the elements we've been talking about apply to telecom-related secrets. There's nothing unusual in terms of what needs to be established in order to have a trade secret in the telecom industry. Some examples of telecom information that have been found to be trade secrets include Google search index and query logs, AT&T's electronic database containing customer information. In that case, a third party had obtained AT&T's billing information for its customers and was using that to target the high billing customers in terms of solicitations for their products. Elements of technology for DVD encryption or for a DVD encryption system, and product descriptions and specifications for international telephones switching systems. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jim.
All right, thank you, Mark. What I'm going to be covering at this point is, as the slide suggests, trade secret misappropriation. And as you'll gather from the characters and images here, trade secret misappropriation increasingly is carried out through electronic means. And trade secrets are particularly attractive to data thieves because they occupy a unique space within intellectual property. They're not patented, although they may be patentable. They, unlike patents, can be reverse engineered, and so there is this incentive for data thieves to take them if they can do so without detection, and then claim independent derivation, separate and aside from the trade secret holder, and without getting into the weeds of patent law, maybe they will have a defense to downstream patent infringement. So the secret nature of trade secrets make them a very appealing target for unscrupulous actors. The most common misappropriator, statistics show and our experience dictates, are employees that are going AWOL and business partners. Unequivocally, the highest percentage of bad actors. And it makes sense. They have access to the data and oftentimes are uniquely positioned to understand the value of what the trade secrets present, and they have the access in ways that others may not. So the technology that is available commonly, widely, to bad actors is increasingly easy to use and accessible to bad actors, both within private businesses and, as the news has shown, foreign states. The tools used most often by data thieves in terms of electronic misappropriation are mass storage devices, and really within that category, USB devices are favored. USB devices can be used, particularly by sophisticated users, in ways that aren't necessarily easy to detect. One can see through the examination of the receiving computer that a USB device was inserted, but may not be able to tell if used in the most sneaky track-covering way possible from the USB device alone whether those files that were put on the USB device were uploaded to another computer or sent somewhere else. And so they're easy to use, they're easy to conceal, and hold a lot of data. Other means are email attachments, file transfer protocols, which can take mass amounts of data and transmit them via the internet in a relatively quick and easy way. Cloud-based storage is something that we're increasingly seeing. The vendors that are identified here are just examples. There are others. But increasingly, misappropriators use these resources because they're valuable, useful resources, but they also park their employers' or former employers' trade secrets there, and sometimes nefariously so. So it's a really important resource to identify and check as an employer and business. A couple of real-world examples of how this is done without getting into all the gory details. The first example, it never ceases to amaze that people in very senior positions do things that are ill-advised. We had a case where a couple very senior executives within the company uploaded mass amounts of data to USB devices, and then after having received our cease and desist letter, forensics later showed the day that this individual received the cease and desist letter, they did a Google search to find wiping software, downloaded that software, and tried to erase all evidence of their bad acts. And there were multiple other examples of email misappropriation. Basically, every way you can think of, these particular gentlemen did it. An FTP example was for a very sophisticated client and had a very sophisticated misappropriator. This particular individual used an FTP protocol to lead up to a system update on his laptop and uploaded mass amounts of information in an effort to steal the company's data. It was discovered, fortunately, but that's another way that we've seen this be affected. This is the statutory definition of misappropriation. This is an example from California, but it is the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And so this is applicable pretty widely, as Mark addressed. So misappropriation is acquisition, disclosure, or use of a trade secret. The acquisition needs to be by improper means, possession alone. If someone truly has forgotten that they have the data and hasn't used or disclosed it, may not be actionable. But acquisition for the purpose of misuse or through hacking through a firewall, violating a company's computer use policy, are all means of circumstantial evidence that can be used to show that the acquisition was improper. Disclosure and use are pretty straightforward and are often the cleanest ways, so to speak, to demonstrate misappropriation. Threatened misappropriation, I won't spend a lot of time on, but is actually important. In California, again, this is an example from California, but other jurisdictions also recognize threatened misappropriation, and there are some jurisdictions that recognize inevitable disclosure, which is slightly different than and more encompassing than threatened misappropriation. But the idea here is that by virtue of being possessed with the former employer's, the business's trade secrets, a former employee or a bad actor, based on past conduct or known conduct, as enumerated here, presents an imminent threat to use or disclose those trade secrets in a way that may irreparably harm or damage the trade secret holder. So, areas of concern specific to telecoms. Again, telecom is such a broad term. We thought we would give some more tangible examples here. So, communication infrastructure technologies, fiber optics, bandwidth, switching. These are technologies that are widely used in telecom and in many respects are public, but there are aspects of these technologies that can be trade secret as far as particular capacities on particular routes, pricing for use of those fiber optics, bandwidth switching, particular hardware that's used within that context may all, depending on whether the other elements of trade secret are met, also be trade secret. Cloud providers and data centers. Non-public information concerning data center systems, methods, scalability, efficiency, and reliability are also eligible for trade secret protection. There are numerous providers that have patented their methods, and really every patent is born as a trade secret. And so this is another area of sensitivity that needs attention. Keeping in mind relationships with vendors and all those who flow through, so to speak, as far as building and observing the physical infrastructure and designing those facilities should be tightly locked down with non-disclosure agreements and have very clear written obligations about use, knowledge of that data and those configurations. Wireless hardware providers, this is kind of classic research and development information, business plans, and don't forget, sometimes self-critical analyses and negative results can also be trade secrets. So if a particular provider or manufacturer has tried a certain thing and has not made that public and has learned from that, those negative results may also be instructive and economically valuable within this space. Cable television and satellite television. Sometimes folks think, well, you know, these are regulated entities, and a lot of what they do is out in the open by virtue of their business models. True, but that doesn't mean there aren't trade secrets. Think about trade secrets of what I refer to as a shorter shelf life, business and marketing plans, initiatives that have high monetary value, even for a short period, that if known to a competitor would put the trade secret holder at a distinct disadvantage. Confidentiality clauses in contracts, particularly for cable and dish providers, satellite providers. Think about those contracts in which you are executing with the content providers, the studios, and the other providers that actually provide the content for broadcast. Those provisions can be very locked down as far as pricing it in those terms, and it behooves the recipient broadcaster to keep those as tightly locked down as possible to hedge against risk. So very quickly, remedies. This, again, is a California example, but in many jurisdictions, this also is available. Actual damages, unjust enrichment, a reasonable royalty if the former two cannot be shown, punitive damages may be available, or attorney's fees, either for willful misappropriation or the reverse can also be true if a trade secret claim is brought in bad faith, which is a term of art that we won't get into today, but it should be noticed by potential plaintiffs to make sure they've done their factual investigation. Remedies as far as injunctive relief. Almost all trade secret suits start off with a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction. The confidential nature of the intellectual property requires that the trade secret holder immediately act, as Mark has noted. If you don't do that in a timely way, under your circumstances, you're going to start from behind the ball. Permanent injunctions are also possible, but not frequent, frankly, because courts don't like to administer them. And again, I put royalty here as a possibility because really it is a form of injunction, so to speak. It's not a favored remedy, but it is one that sometimes gets issued, particularly where it's difficult to discern the monetary value of the particular trade secret and how it has found its way into commerce by the misappropriator. But there are clear examples of where royalties are imposed, and courts often use patent infringement royalty-based precedent to derive and set what are appropriate royalties. The pros of injunctive relief is they can be very powerful, and you are freezing things in place while the details are worked out through the remainder of the litigation. Certain injunctions can be extremely powerful in terms of putting the commercial skids on your competitor. We've seen some of this in noteworthy patent litigation. Apple, Samsung comes to mind, and going a different route through ITC proceedings, preventing the importation through injunction of infringing devices is also a potential big benefit. The cons of injunctive relief and trade secret litigation in general. It's very front-loaded and can be very expensive, particularly when dealing with multiple misappropriators and sophisticated defendants. The cases tend to be very circumstantial, and that involves really digging in, understanding what's been done, hiring experts, computer forensics analysis, so on and so forth. The upside with that is that the case law recognizes, and there are multiple examples of this. Again, this is just one case from California that says, look, we get it. This stuff doesn't always turn on direct evidence, and circumstantial evidence can be persuasive. With that, I would like to turn the presentation over to my colleague and partner, Justin Beyer.
Thanks, Jim. Before we go any further, I do want to really quickly read the CLE attendance affirmation code. This is going to be the only time that we are going to provide that code, so please write it down now. To receive CLE credit for the webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you by the end of the week. The code is S as in Sam, 8159. Again, that's SS 8159. Turning back to our presentation, social media has emerged as one of the great marketing drivers of the 21st century. You see hosts of companies who are using it for branding purposes, companies who wish to create a lifestyle, and particularly in the telecom market. I think all of us have seen the very successful commercials where DirecTV pits itself against Comcast, or Comcast pits itself against DirecTV, Apple versus Google, AT&T versus Sprint versus Verizon. And those marketing campaigns aren't simply limited these days to television advertisements or radio advertisements. You're starting to see them also in the form of social media. Now, the reason that's important, obviously, is because when you look at the numbers of users and the amount of content that's being utilized in this industry, you have access to huge amounts of end users of products. Looking at Facebook, which has over 1 billion users at this point, LinkedIn, which the slides is 161, but I think that number might be a little dated. It's now over 200 million. Google Plus has over 400 million. YouTube has hundreds of millions of users. And with that type of access, you see advertisers being able to produce and promote their product through alternative sources. Twitter has over 500 million users. I think all of us who have Twitter feeds have probably seen promoted products. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a business world where social media has become an accepted and important form of marketing. It's become ubiquitous in the market. We have companies that pay to have their products advertised on Facebook, promoted on Twitter, fan pages created on Facebook. The problem with this, though, is that at the same time that these marketing campaigns are taking place, from our experience, we're seeing a number of situations where companies aren't taking as strict precautions as they probably need to monitor their employees' use of social media, particularly where that social media site is being promoted by the company. We're going to talk about a few specific cases at this point, but before we go into the ones that are on the screen, this is a trend that is really rapidly growing in litigation. Last month, we saw a case involving allegations of improper solicitations of former employees through Twitter and Facebook. Just yesterday, Rubbermaid filed a claim in state court in Georgia where they alleged that an unknown defendant using three Twitter handles had improperly disseminated its trade secrets to various news organizations in the Atlanta market. So we have these instances in which trade secrets are being disseminated at the same time that we have instances in which the social media sites are also being used for purposes of improper solicitations. PhoneDog is one of those cases that goes to the question of who actually owns a social media site. Now, PhoneDog has a somewhat unique business model in which all of their employees are assigned particular Twitter handles. And the purpose of those Twitter handles then are to make certain reviews of online content. It can be other types of media content. Following the departure of one of those particular employees, the employee continued to utilize the Twitter handle and effectively changed the name of the Twitter feed and had 17,000 followers as a byproduct of that. Now, PhoneDog turned around and sued. They sought compensation. And the defendant in that case, Kravitz, claimed there was no ownership interest in the account, that they couldn't establish that the followers actually constituted a trade secret and could not establish the actual value of an individual follower to the account. PhoneDog claimed that each follower was worth $2.50 to the company every month that this particular employee had access to the account and would not give the account back to PhoneDog. Now, the case ended up settling out of court, but it really is it's the first lawsuit that we've seen where a company has sought to put a price tag on the worth of a Twitter user. The next case that we have is a case, Artist Health versus Dan Cavell, and that's a case coming out of the Southern District of New York. Now, the question in that case was, Nankivell was effectively an independent contractor who Artist Health and a number of other health clubs had hired to promote their product. After she left their employ, she refused to turn over passwords to websites and social media sites that while she was employed by Artist Health, she had managed and maintained. Problem with that, she hadn't entered into an agreement with Artist in which she agreed that all the content was Artist Health's and that she must return it upon request. She argued that there would be no irreparable harm because the websites and blogs were not updated. Now, that's interesting from the defense standpoint because she didn't argue that it wasn't actually Artist Health's property. She just argued that basically they had relinquished the right to it by failing to update the account. The court disagreed at the end of the day and ordered Nankinville to provide the passwords. So why are these cases important? Well, it demonstrates that from the outside of an employment relationship, if an employer is going to ask the employee to have some responsibility for creating content, updating Twitter handles, updating Facebook pages, that they need to establish from the outset who actually owns that. You want to really do this before the actual issues, problems arise. Typically, again, when an employee leaves, an employee becomes disgruntled. In the long run, we believe that creating these type of policies and including this type of, you know, contractual relationship will actually help employers avoid potential litigation situations. To that end, there are certain things that will guide an employer, however, as they move forward and try to create social media policies. The main ones of which are going to be the National Labor Relations Board and a California law in dealing with invasion of right to privacy. At this point in time, California seems to be unique on that front. Though there are other states that do have invasion of privacy laws, they probably don't relate as much to social media, like New York, which talks about likenesses, or Montana, which does have a provision in its constitution talking about privacy. At this point, California is the only one that has has a personal right of action, private right of action, excuse me. First and foremost, the National Labor Relations Board, the National Labor Relations Act, excuse me, provides guidance to employers about access and the ability to form unions. How that comes into play with social media policies is that companies have to make sure that their policies don't restrict an employee as the employee attempts or seeks to attempt to organize. In other words, if the communications are between employees who might be seen as attempting to organize a union, a company can't restrict those types of communications. National Labor Relations Board will treat a mere gripe, however, about a company as not typically being protected communication. Trying to provide guidance, the NLRB has issued three reports, and those three reports have focused on about 20 company policies. Now, problematically for the companies who are attempting to be proactive in this case, NLRB has found that 16 of those were overbroad, and they found that that the issues particularly arose when companies attempted to curtail certain Facebook and Twitter posts. The most recent NLRB report on this came out in May 30th, 2012. A couple of the important points to draw from that report, a disclaimer, the NLRB found that a disclaimer was not sufficient to cure a defective policy. In other words, even if a company included something in the policy that said this is not intended to curtail your right to attempt to form a union, that wasn't sufficient if there were overbreadth issues elsewhere in the report. While this title is entitled What is Acceptable, the reality is it's probably more dealing with what is not acceptable. And unfortunately, there's a handful of things that are deemed not acceptable by the NLRB. You can't blanketly prohibit sharing of confidential information in a social media policy if you don't list what the categories of non-NLRB protected information is. You can't provide a warning that online posting should be completely accurate and not misleading. You can't have a policy requiring an employee to communicate in a quote-unquote professional tone and also quote-unquote without making objectionable or inflammatory comments. And you can't restrict an employee's contact with the media. What employers should be seeking to do is create policies that articulate the business interests at stake. And in our experiences, what you're realistically talking about there is protection of trade secrets, confidential and proprietary information. And as well, you should include examples of what trade secrets, confidential and proprietary information. In our experience, the best place to start is by looking to your non-compete agreements and your confidentiality agreements and just pulling the definition directly from there. Going back to the California Invasion of Right to Privacy Act, it's one of the only states to offer a private right of action. In this particular case, in order to, for a plaintiff to prove the case, he or she needs to prove they had a legally protected privacy interest, a reasonable expectation of privacy, and conduct by a defendant constituting a serious invasion of privacy. To date, thankfully, we haven't seen anything arise on the social media front. Now, that said, in my career, I've seen instances, though, where employers have viewed their employees' LinkedIn messages or Facebook messages on a work computer. Employers do need to be careful in doing so, particularly if they don't have clearly defined internet or work computer usage policies. Some important takeaways from the social media side of things. One, you really want to make sure as an employer that your policies don't run afoul of the National Labor Relations Act. That is probably more confusing than it needs to be, unfortunately, but at this particular time, there is some direction that employers can take, and mainly that's going to be not being seen as restricting communications that are potentially for the purpose of organizing in union. The second thing is that companies really need to ensure that there's a contractual right to the social media pages, passwords, content at the outset of giving an employee the ability to provide information in that front. So what are some of the best practices that companies can take to protect their trade secrets? First and foremost, there are internal policies that they can implement. One of those is onboarding checklists and confidentiality policies. There are many, many times where we see instances in which companies have very good contracts in place, very good agreements in place, but because during the hiring process, there wasn't sufficient oversight, to make sure that those were signed where employees haven't signed, and now companies are scrambling during the middle of employment trying to make decisions on how to best protect their information. Second policy is work from home policies. Many times, as Jim mentioned, we see instances in which there are exfiltration of trade secret information through other electronic means. One of those is through VPN access if people are working from home computers and there aren't policies and procedures in place to prevent printing of information from home moving that information from a VPN onto a personal computer. Another important policy is really clearly defining what needs to be asked in an exit interview and what types of information and reminders should be given in that exit interview. You'd be amazed at what information you can acquire, where the employee is going, or if an employee refuses to disclose where it's going, that might be a red flag to an employer. Also providing reminders to return any documents, anything from home, any USB drives. You also have USB usage. And really, we're going to talk about that in greater detail in the next slide or two, but one question that has to be asked is it really necessary for your company's business? Is there other ways that employees can have access to that information? Secure VPN sites, content that is directly on their laptops. You also have social media, which we've covered in great detail in previous slides. And then cell phone usage. We're going to talk about that a bit as well, but there are some unfortunate abilities to exfiltrate information on a cell phone that most companies aren't aware of. And really, there should be procedures at the beginning of employment to make decisions about whether or not employees can use their personal cell phone, whether employees can have personal email accounts on the same device on which they have a business email account. Whether or not it makes sense for the company to have actual company cell phones, which the employee is required to turn over at the end of employment. I had a case recently where an employer sought a return of an employee's phone or the SIM card, claiming that the information on the SIM card constituted in a customer list. The employee refused, saying the phone was his, he had paid for it, he'd paid the bills on it, and it was one of those situations where the employer was sort of left in a bind because there was really no way for them to return it short of expensive litigation. There's also very important things that companies should take into consideration from an information technology perspective. One thing that some employers do is they disable the USB drive usage. That's something that can be accomplished on Windows devices fairly simply with work from your information technology department. And that's a great way to really protect that information. There's also USB drive usage software, which various companies put out, and then can monitor and track usage of the drive. They can track the documents that are downloaded. It can track the device name, its unique PIN number, things like that. There are also data loss prevention tools where it's more of a network tool which monitors whether core documents are being emailed or used or who's opening them. Now, one of the problems with that type of solution, however, is that you really need to be diligent as a company for defining what core documents are and then consistently updating them. There's also some crossover software which enables you to link that data loss prevention software through like a data management system where any updates to the document are automatically updating that as a core document. The problem if you don't have that type of linking software is you may have an original document that's marked as a core document, but any changes that are made to that document aren't going to then be registered as a core document. There's also file sites. Various organizations use software that basically within the software package you can track views, copying, changes to documents, but companies should be aware of so-called key logging software in that case. There's also software to prevent printing of sensitive documents. Again, it's an issue with having it's an issue of having the documents actually marked as being sensitive. A couple other things that companies can do, they can perform a trade secret audit. Effectively, in that situation, you'd hire a third-party consultant who would effectively log in as an employee and would attempt to see how easy or difficult it is to move information out of there. Now, this is one of those things where we recommend if you do perform an audit that you do it on a somewhat regular basis. With the way that technology is emerging, we're looking at situations, unfortunately, where the technology to exfiltrate information is quickly outpacing the technology used to prevent that. And then the final thing is companies should really consider mobile device management software. Now, I didn't know this until I talked to someone recently, but apparently one of the things that you can do to bypass security measures of a company is that you can effectively, on a smartphone or on an iPhone in particular, you can pull up information and you could forward that via email. But if you have a personal email account on that same phone, you can change the sender, and effectively you have moved confidential information off of a company's system without it ever showing up to the company, because now all you have is an email that's taking a place between a Yahoo account or a Gmail account or something to that effect. A couple other considerations. Has a company actually defined what constitutes a trade secret? It's very easy when you're talking about the secret sauce or the recipe to Coca-Cola. It's harder when you're talking about business secrets. In our experience, if companies have done this in advance, they're in a better position than if they're defining it at the time that they're looking at litigation. As we talked a little bit, what do you do about phones? And also, what do you do about cell cameras? It may not be feasible in this technological era to ban employees from using their phones at work, and it's even harder to figure out what to do when the phone can just take a snapshot of the computer screen. And then finally, in addition to looking at the internal policies and the IP precautions with relation to employees, is the company ready if someone attempted to hack it? Sometimes it's easier to deal with a disgruntled employee than it is to deal with a hacker who simply is intent on moving information. Quickly, we're going to cover some of the things that companies should be doing to try to protect their trade secrets in court and government interactions. There are a few rules that are in place in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Rule 26 permits protective orders. Rule 45 permits companies to quash information. Should be noted, however, that these are limited protections. In 1985, the District Court of Delaware actually ordered the secret formulas of Coke to be produced in discovery. So if the secret to Coke can be produced, anything can be produced. There's also open questions about what happens when you actually get the trial. If trade secrets are disclosed to the jury during trial, does it maintain trade secret protection? What do you want to do? Well, first and foremost, you need to plan ahead. You need to build in time in litigation to maintain the protection. We all know that trade secret litigation really starts fast, but companies should be aware and should be ready to make the protections and take the time to protect their information before it goes into court, or at a minimum to try to get to make their filings under seal. Also, at the same time, you want to prepare for trial, how to properly regulate access while handling confidential exhibits that might be seeking to bar employees from the courtroom while it's being presented, and also entering into agreements with third-party vendors to maintain the confidentiality and destroy the information after litigation. In government interactions, there's a couple of things that are specifically relevant to companies. One of those is the Freedom of Information Act, Federal Communications Commission, and the Patents and Trademarks and Copyrights. All of those permit companies to redact trade secret information. All of those permit the government from turning over what constitutes trade secrets. Obviously, that is relying on the government to make the proper determination if a FOIA request comes in. So that really puts it on the companies when they're in a place of having to turn over information to proactively mark it as confidential or trade secret or redacted. Now I'm going to turn the presentation back over to Jim McNary.
Thanks very much, Justin. We have just a couple minutes left, so I'm going to move through this material relatively quickly. But this subject is, federal actions that may help better protect trade secrets. In 2012, the federal government really started to roll out an awareness initiative as to trade secrets and their value to American businesses. The first image that you see is actually produced by the FBI. They rolled out billboards in 2012 with this information. They have a website dedicated to this topic. The second image is from the link page to the FBI's Red Dart initiative, which is another manifestation of protecting intellectual property from cyber threats, both from foreign states, as has been in the news a lot recently, but also keeping in mind business partners and employees and former employees are also part of the threat here. So federal actions that may help better protect trade secrets include amendments to the Economic Espionage Act, the Theft of Trade Secrets and Clarification Act, and the EEA Penalty Enhancement Act. Both broaden the conduct and information types that are subject to the EEA, and as to penalties, increase the penalties both for individuals who violate the act as well as organizations. What is still not present in the EEA, but which is under continued consideration and much discussion, is enactment of a civil remedy that would allow companies to pursue on their own, as opposed through the government, misappropriators. This could be potentially powerful when one thinks of asserting jurisdiction over foreign actors. Just on February 12th, the Cybersecurity Executive Order. For those who have looked at it, that it's just a order at this point that says, look, this is an important subject and we need to do more, and there are details that need to be fleshed out. And those details will be important. I think everyone who is watching this is hoping very much that the government will take the lead in listening to the concerns articulated by trade secret holders. Some of the evidence of that are the Protecting American Trade Secrets and Innovation Act, which was introduced by Cole, and proposed amendments to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Both of those are under consideration, and both of those do help, in their current form anyway, address the needs of employers in American business, that is, to have private rights of action to certain jurisdiction, to have a civil cause of action for those who exceed authorized access to their employer's computer systems, which right now is subject to a split in the federal circuits. In the Ninth Circuit, one really needs to, in order to be civilly liable under the CFAA, by some people's perspectives, including Judge Kaczynski, to have hacked into a computer network, not merely have violated company computer use policy or exceeded his or her authorized access, whereas other circuits are more forgiving, such as the Second, although the law is mixed. Really, the following slides I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but as further evidence that the government is starting to catch up to what has been known to private industry for some time, the Department of Homeland Security has a national cybersecurity division. And although the group is not broad, they are very interested in trying to be helpful. And all of this information that you see on this page comes from the head of that group. I presented a handful of months ago on a panel where she was present, and she had a lot of good things to say about their interests and abilities to help businesses in their efforts to identify threats and to do all that they can to help American business get things in the best position to defend against internal and external cyber threats. But of course, as with most things along these lines, private companies are best positioned to be proactive on their own and obviously not rely upon the Department of Homeland Security to affect change. You see from this slide, these are just several iterations and levels of cybersecurity that the DHS offers. I have had people report back to me that when they make use of these links, there's valuable information provided, and that those on the other end, the recipients at DHS, do respond and are interactive. With that, we are at the end of our presentation, and if anyone has any questions, given that we've run over, please feel free to contact us directly if there is something more we can help you with. You can see here our contact information, including our email. Thank you very much for your time today, and have a good day.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes today's web conference. You may now disconnect.